This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wallace Shayanko was the first African to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. That was in 1986. Shayanko is also a longtime activist in the Nigerian and Pan-African democracy movements. He spent time in prison for criticizing his government. Last June, Nigeria held its first presidential election in 10 years. But when MK Abiola won by a landslide, the country's military dictator, General Babangida, annulled the election. But Babangida promised to give up power by the end of August, and he did transfer power to a civilian ruler. But that government was soon overthrown in a military coup led by Babangida's number two man. That regime remains in place. Shoyenka remains in the opposition. He's visiting the United States, and tonight at New York University, he will give the keynote address at an American Film Institute conference on black cinema, a celebration of Pan-African film. Shayanka last joined us in August, shortly after the Nigerian election was annulled and there were riots and protest. Today I asked Shayanka to fill us in on what's happened to him in the interim.
I was caught up in the rioting myself in Lagos the second day, which is the worst of the lot. That was, I've forgotten the dates now, sometime in August, shortly after the cancellation of the elections. And they were quite violent. At least 200 people were killed in the streets of Lagos. I saw some of the bodies myself, especially when I came on a scene where the riot police had just been firing and the whole place was total chaos. Then, after a while, I came out to lend some international support to the campaign for the recognition of the president-elect and to mobilize opinion against the continued stay of the military. And I was here, I was in Washington, D.C., I met some congressmen, I did lots of interviews, and the pace hotted up. And by the time I was ready to return, I received a message that I could not ignore, that I should postpone my return for quite a while. So I stayed out for about another 6 weeks.
Can I ask you how you find out about this kind of thing? You know, how you find out that it's not safe for you to go back?
Oh, well, we have a very good communication system, and we have support within the military, within even the security services, among the police. Not all government officials, even in the diplomatic corps, in the the foreign service, and so on and so forth. So, getting information of that nature has become almost routine.
And was there anything like a list that your name was on? Is it?
Yes, there was a list, all right, and it didn't take too much imagination to know all those whose names were on the list. I was a very special case because what the regime needed to sustain its lies was international recognition, and the advisors of that government, the conspirators, shall we say, against the forces of democracy, recognized very early on that individuals like myself stood very much in the way of the kind of recognition which the regime wanted internationally.
So when you went back, were you able to resume something like normal life in Nigeria?
Not immediately. The moment I arrived, my passport was seized. In fact, the security people wanted to whisk me away for questioning, but the people who were around at the time, at the exit of the airport, made sure that nothing of that nature happened, so I left my passport with them. But a few days later, they themselves brought it to my office with apologies, and so you could say that normal life resumed a few days, for me, a few days after I returned.
So you're living under a relatively new military regime now.
Yes, relatively new military regime, which we refuse to recognize. And by that I mean the democratic forces, the alliance of the various democratic groups, and the masses of the people in Nigeria just simply do not accept the legitimacy of this government. So we're back in a kind of hiatus, a political hiatus.
What are some of the activities that the government has banned?
Well, the government hasn't banned any activity as such. It's clamped down on attempted meetings by the pro-democracy forces. It's interrupted the activities of individuals. It's arrested one or two prominent democratic voices on charges of sedition. It's tried without success to muzzle certain sections of the press, but these attempts blew up in the face of the government, and they had to backtrack and even deny knowing, you know, the right hand denying what the left hand was doing. It's a government which is caught in a welter of contradictions, and it tries on the one hand to woo some of the pro-democracy leaders, and succeeded to some extent, that is true. There are a couple of pro-democracy voices serving with this regime. They take a calculated risk that they might be able to turn the government around to recognize the aspirations of the democracy voices and the elections of last year. But of course, this is, from our point of view, very naive. At the same time, of course, the regime wants to stay, wants to survive. It's very much afraid of the restless junior ranks within the military, junior ranks who are disgusted with the past profligacy, the corruption, and just misgovernment of its own leadership, its own representatives. They're very restless. And so this regime is literally riding on the tiger's back and is afraid to end up inside it.
Do you think elections will ever be held in your country at this rate?
Well, there's something which I can tell you, that as long as the election result of last year, June 12th, is not resolved one way or another, there will not be acceptable elections in that country.
So would you like to see the person who won that election in June actually serve as president?
It'll be the most obvious solution to go back and respect the wishes of the people, wishes which were expressed in such an unambiguous way, right across so-called tribes, right across states, religions. It was a unique achievement in the history of Nigeria. And a lot of money was burnt, you know, arriving at that watershed in our post-colonial history. And for any individual or a small clique of individuals or interests to negate, you know, this perhaps for other nations modest achievement, but for us and for the majority of African countries, an enormous achievement. For any section to negate it is an act of, it constitutes an act of treason.
What is the agenda of the current military regime besides staying in power?
I was about to say, to hang on. It has no agenda whatever. It's a no government. It's a no government. It's not respected by anybody. And there is only one chance for this regime to salvage itself, and that is to acknowledge that its very existence is anomalous, and that there is only one way forward, and that is to enthrone the will of the people as expressed on June 12, 1993.
The day of the election.
The day of the election.
So how do you see your role now as a writer and political activist in Nigeria?
I have to confess that sometime last year, I went through quite a brief period of intense pessimism. The reason being that some of our colleagues accepted to serve in the government, They had their reasons, but for me it was such a blunder because it gave a semblance of legitimacy to the regime. But one gets over that sort of period very quickly, and one is back again in business. And my function is simply to continue to articulate what I recognize as the voice of the majority of the people in Nigeria, their legitimate aspirations, their demands for a voice in their own affairs, which for me is a very elementary property of any human being, mature individual within society.
Did the government ever approach you to see if you were willing to come over and lend your support?
Good question. Not just this regime, but even the interim government. But before I left home, for instance, there had been several messages from the government, from an official representative very high up within the government, asking for a meeting, you know. And I said, look, I'm willing to talk anytime, but this is my position. And if what you want to talk about is how to resolve and arrive at what I consider a just resolution, sure, I'm standing by. I've never hesitated to talk to governments, never.
So did you have a talk, or did they not?
Not yet. By the
that?
Time I left, we didn't get in touch, but I imagine we will when I return.
Do you have outlets where you can write your opinions about the government, or are those outlets being censored now?
No, there's no question at all. There's no problem. Mm-hmm. Whatever the papers are willing to print, I'm always willing to say. I hold press conferences. I write articles. Recently, on the occasion of the Martin Luther King Memorial Day, celebrated for the first time on the African continent in Benin, Nigerian Mount Country, I delivered a speech, which, you know, I seized the opportunity just to remind the military that what we were celebrating, the man whom we were celebrating, was a man of peace, not a man of the gun, and that the military had no place at all in any such occasions. In fact, I stated that if the military had appeared there, I would have walked out of that gathering, and I would have done it, because my policy at the moment, the strategy which I have recommended for everybody, is to isolate the military in all spheres of life, of social life, wherever it can be done, and to just make them realize, to put psychological pressure on them, that made them realize that they're not wanted, and also to sensitize people towards the next moment of confrontation, because it's inevitable there will be further confrontations if the military does not bow to popular democratic will. It's only a matter of time.
Well, it's the job of the military to put psychological pressure on you. I mean, how do you put psychological pressure on them?
Well, we are more than they are to start with, and once I get my ideas across to the masses of the people, to interest groups, including business interest groups, they have proved themselves in this past struggle to be quite a responsible, committed, and a formidable force. And there are several ways in which the people as a whole can put psychological pressure on the military, whittle away even the basis of their support, of the support of the leadership within the army itself. The military can, I think that by now, the military must realize that I'm rather insensitive to any psychological pressure which they've mounted on me in the past, such as last year, for instance, when the police helicopter was sent to keep buzzing my house just to make me feel insecure. Those little games I don't think would be tried any longer, because they just never worked.
Well, how did you feel when the helicopter kept buzzing your house?
I just wish I'd had a bazooka to shoot it down, that's all.
Did it make you nervous? Did you think they were coming to attack you or take you away? Or
well,
did you
were
just being harassed by the sound?
Yeah, just being harassed. And also, I have no doubt they were taking aerial photographs. Because this was my new house, which I've been building for the past 10 years, and it's rather isolated. So the idea was to make me feel quite vulnerable, to let me know that they knew where I was and I could be reached at any time. It's just a silly, childish game, which didn't work either for me or for Gani Fawa Emi, another human rights activist who was similarly intimidated, and a couple of other people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wole Soyinka, the Nigerian writer who won a Nobel Prize back in 1986. He's visiting the States. In fact, he will be addressing an American Film Institute conference on black film this evening at NYU in Manhattan. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Wole Soyinka, Nigerian writer who won the Nobel Prize in 1986. I'm wondering, when you make one of your visits to the United States, if you're interested at all in examining the latest racial issues and racial-related controversies in the States.
Well, I do get drawn into arguments about them and, among my colleagues. And I have... In fact, I remember I gave a lecture in a university in which I tried to warn about the distortions which can come in academia of political positions, distortions of actualities of history, of the reading of history. So I get involved from time to time, but America is a very strange place. It's a land of extremes. You people tend to swing from one extreme of absurdity to the next in the process of trying to correct one absurdity. I find that there's a tendency then to swing to the very opposite extreme and even falsify history in the process.
Is there an example of what you're describing that you can
I got involved in examining the issue of slavery, for instance, and this has to do with the politics of the blacks and the Jews in the United States, mm-hmm. which is a very controversial point. And my position simply was that, look, whatever is the actuality of the politics in Nigeria at the moment, the history of the slavery, the repository of the truth, is not in the hands of black Americans only. It is, even more pertinently, a responsibility of African scholars themselves from where the slaves came originally, and that the history, the reality must not be tampered with simply to score a political point within the politics of the United States. That sort of situation. It's a question of swinging from our submissive position in society, trying to remedy and to retrieve the dignity of the black individual here, and establish permanently his rightful place and rights within society. And in that process, try and distort history as it relates to another group within the society. I find that proceeding very shaky, very suspect, very academically dishonest, and... Yes, I have been involved in that kind of discussion.
Is there a person or a group that you're thinking of when you talk about tampering with history?
Well, I'm thinking of a group and individuals, but I don't live in this country, so since I only come in and fire one or two shots and go away, I don't like I don't like to mention their names. I leave that to others.
Okay. As an African, when you come to America and get caught up in issues pertaining to the African-American community here, do you find that you're sometimes called on to be almost like an arbiter because you're from Africa and therefore you might have certain insights that would be different historically or culturally?
Yes, I'm called on sometimes to be an arbiter, but that ends very shortly because there's, from my point of view, there are certain truths about which there is no arbitration. I'll give you an example. I gave a lecture sometime, and during question time, I was there's a question from the floor, and I insisted on the historical truth of what I was saying, and I was shocked by the response, which was that, well, historical truth, in effect, what it was saying is that this may be historical truth, but if I may borrow this expression, which I hate so much, but that was more or less the implication that political correctness permitted one to tamper with the historical truth. Now, I in that sort of situation, I'm never an arbiter. I take sides immediately. Very strong, very definite position. So I'm not a very good arbiter.
What had you mentioned in the speech that provoked that?
Oh, it was a question of the whole participation of the Jews in the slave trade and things like that, you know.
And what had you said about that?
No, I just said people should try and get their facts right. And that, you know, the evidence, which is that since all my research on the continent of Africa, I haven't seen a Jewish fort, a Jewish slave fort. And I'm involved in the entire, there's something called the slave route, which is a very fascinating program, supposed to bring even African Americans to the African continent. You know, it involves tourism, scholarship, the arts, culture, history, the whole lot. It's a very big project. And I remember remarking that I was not about to build some Jewish forts just to satisfy some interests here. If there are any, we'll bring them out. But if there are none, we know there are Dutch, there's some German forts, British, of course, French, all these are, you know, they're there, they're extant, they're real. But we haven't yet found a Jewish fort, and I wish people would, you know, stop introducing into a situation things which are not real. It's not honest.
Is there a counterpart in Nigeria of political correctness that you see in the United States?
No, I'm afraid that particular infliction has not, thank goodness, reached Nigeria. I don't even understand that expression, political correctness. I mean, I know how many purposes it's made to serve, but I find it such a meaningless expression. And, of course, it's an opportunistic one. Because it covers so many sins, so many crimes, so many persecutions. I encounter it all the time in the academic field in this country.
Well, Ashayanka, I wish you a good stay in the United States, a good return trip to Nigeria, and I thank you very much for spending some of your time here with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Well, Ashayanka is a Nobel Prize-winning Nigerian writer. This evening at New York University, he will give the keynote address at an American Film Institute conference on Pan-African film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.